From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
In the Outer Sunset.
Suffolk Market.
Union City.
In the 69th Village.
It's not the dog patch, it's just dog patch.
Coming up, we'll hear how a grocery store moving into an Oakland neighborhood cost its residents a bus stop.
There was no public vote on the bus stop removal.
Then we'll hear what it was like growing up in the family of Cesar Chavez.
He left me with a sense of pride and a sense in my identity, who I am.
And we'll meet the omnipotent force behind a long-running fantasy game.
We're all here to try to experience something where we can be heroic.
Battles, big and small. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. In Oakland, the AC Transit 51A bus line runs from Rockridge down Broadway to Alameda. Now, one bus stop on its route has become the center of a political battle. Reporter Bonnie Chan tells us why in a story brought to us from the UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
In Oakland, a neighborhood around Broadway and 30th Street is called Pill Hill, for a good reason. There's a Sutter Alta Bates Medical Center and lots of doctor's offices, including oncologists, optometrists, and dentists. Chris Peoples knows the area well. He had a stroke 5 years ago, and he relies on the bus to get to his doctors.
So I do not walk comfortably or easily. And so now when my eye doctor is further up 30th Street and have to see them every 6 months or so.
But a year ago, the bus stop at Broadway and 30th Street disappeared without any public discussion. That bothered Peoples for a number of reasons. For one thing, he rides that bus. For another, he's board president of AC Transit, and even he couldn't do anything about it except walk farther.
And so I end up having to walk down from the street that Summit is on, and then when I'm coming back down here to where I work, I end up having to walk all the way down to 28th, which when you've just had your annual physical is a pain.
So what happened to the bus stop? Well, a new grocery store called Sprouts wanted to move into the neighborhood a few years ago, and the developer proposed moving the bus stop from the northwest corner of Broadway and 30th to the southwest corner. The developer agreed to pay for improvements, like a new bus shelter. Both the city and AC Transit liked the idea because the new location was safer and more efficient for bus riders. But Summit Bank didn't like it. It's a community bank located on that southwest corner. Bank officials fought hard against having a bus stop in front of their branch, citing security concerns. So city officials removed the stop altogether, which made Oakland City Council member Rebecca Kaplan very angry.
There was no public vote on the bus stop removal. So the issue that the community is suffering from here involves not only the loss of transit service, which would be bad enough, but it did not take place through any sort of public process.
At a press conference on April 12th, Kaplan strongly supported reinstating the bus stop, saying it served a mostly older, low-income population that relies on public transit.
We are talking about a location that serves medical services, that serves grocery stores, and where else should be a priority to have transit service than a location like that on a major transit corridor with access to hundreds of new housing units coming in, and grocery stores and medical services.
Over the last year, bus riders and advocates have raised a ruckus of their own. Kit Vack is a transit advocate who helped organize protests in front of Summit Bank.
We gave the bank Christmas cards that said, "Don't be a Grinch, Summit Bank, bring back our bus stop." And the responses that we got from the bank was they'd call the police on us.
Last month, at a Public Works Committee meeting, the city finally committed to reinstate the bus stop. It remains to be seen how long that will take. Meanwhile, Summit Bank hired crisis management pro Sam Singer to help make the case that the stop goes somewhere else.
We would continue to oppose the bank being the place for the bus stop. Where we want to see it be is where it's been for 100 years, which is right in front of Sprouts, where it ought to return.
For now, transit advocates say their goal is for the city to have a Department of Transportation in charge of decisions like this, with oversight, to make sure people who rely on public transit don't lose out again. The city council approved funding for the new department last summer, and Oakland city officials are now working on recruiting a director of transportation. Meanwhile, bus riders wait for the city to return their missing bus stop. In Oakland, I'm Bonnie Chan for Cross Currents.
Bonnie Chan is a student reporter at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanna Baba. Now we'll go from the bus line to the picket line. Cesar Chavez is remembered for leading the struggle to reform labor laws for exploited workers, and his United Farm Workers movement grabbed the attention of the world. Chavez organized nonviolent protests, hunger strikes, grape boycotts, and marches throughout California, which ultimately led to many improvements for farm workers. Chavez was also a father of eight children. His oldest son, Fernando Chavez, is an attorney in San Jose. He works with many Latino clients, handling cases involving employment disputes, personal injury, and immigration. For our latest series on the families of revolutionaries, KALW's Lila Day sat down with Fernando Chavez and asked him what was it like at home growing up with a revolutionary father.
We always say, my brothers and sisters and I, especially the older ones, we always say we were the first organizers along with my dad, because when my dad first started organizing in the San Joaquin Valley, it was not uncommon for the children, myself and my three oldest sisters, to go out and help canvass a community with flyers telling the workers that there was going to be a meeting. So that's what we did. So doing that and being part of that, I realized and recognized that he was gone. It was for a purpose. So, you know, when he didn't show up for my baseball games, he didn't show up for my basketball games, you know, I never really took it personal.
Did he ever express that he wanted to be there more, or was it just something that he...
Oh, no, he did. He did. The important events. I mean, he came, let's see. He didn't come to my high school graduation. He didn't come to my college graduation. But he came to my law school graduation. And he came to a couple. He came to when I got married. And he came to a couple of other events.
But in your family circumstance, it's a little different. I mean, your father would go on hunger strikes.
Right.
Right? Did you at all ever feel that he was putting his work before his family?
At that time, no. I think we all recognized that it was dangerous. And the doctors told us it was dangerous. I had no reason to disbelieve him. But, you know, he was so committed to what he was doing. I don't think anybody ever contemplated trying to talk him out of it. The last one he did, I mean, he was already in his 60s. I mean, that was very painful. That took a lot out of him physically. Even, I think, emotionally and spiritually, that drained a lot of his, a big part of his life.
Right, right. And he spent a big part of his life after that getting healthy, trying to get healthy
again. Trying to get healthy.
Mm-hmm. Is it something that you think that you could ever do?
No. It takes a very special person. It's a rare, rare individual. They just, there's not many of them.
When you do have family with such a strong and powerful history, do you feel that that's something that that your father was born with, or something that he sort of learned?
That's a very good question. I don't know whether anybody's born like that. I would think that people are moved, motivated, and shaped by events in their life. If people ask me, well, what were you left? I mean, what did he leave you? Obviously, he never left you money. He didn't leave you a trust fund. He didn't leave you anything. What did he leave you? Well, he left me with a sense of pride, a sense of dignity, a sense of moral obligation, sometimes to a fault, and a sense in my identity, who I am, and what I could be.
Mm-hmm. So I was just going to continue talking about the work that you do. When you first went to law school, was it to practice labor law?
You know, that's funny. I had no inclination nor desire to go to law school. I sort of got swept up in going to law school.
Your family want you to go?
I think my grandmother did. I was going to be an architect. Where, how, and why I had that notion in my head, I have no idea. But that was my thought. I was going to be an architect.
Did your dad like that idea?
I think he did. Mm-hmm. I think he did. It was different. There were very few Latino architects, mm-hmm. Very few lawyers. But when I decided to go to law school, I think he was happy. I thought, you know, he said, well, that's good. That gives you another piece of armor to be able to use in your battle for equality and justice.
I'm speaking with Fernando Chavez, the son of Cesar Chavez. If your father was here today, what issue do you think that he would stand strong behind?
Well, one of the big issues in this country is the whole issue of immigration reform. I think it's absolutely ludicrous that we don't have a comprehensive reform legislation or a bill that would allow some 12 million people to adjust their status.
When you think of your father, what is one of the memories that keep coming back to you?
I have two memories. One where I was when I was very young, and one when I was a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
When my dad was around on weekends in the morning, I distinctly I close my eyes and I can hear it. He would play his music from the 40s, the 50s, big band era. And in the evenings when he was around, I mean, him and my mom we'd sit down, all eight of us, like a theater, and my mom and my dad would dance. And people don't, you know, they think he's such a serious side that he had a really good sense of humor. He had a good sense of humor. And he liked music, he liked jazz. And I just visualize him and mom dancing swing all the time.
That's a very energetic dance as
very well. Very energetic. And they were very good at it.
Well, what were you doing when he was dancing?
Yeah, we'd watch doing? And we'd clap and we'd laugh. And then the other vivid memory I have is when I got a little bit older and he was organizing. And this happened so many times that the first events, what would happen is we'd go into community, we'd leaflet, and they'd say there's going to be a meeting at someone's home. Come so you can learn about your rights and joining a union, what have you. And since I was the eldest, I would go with him. And I remember going to the first 10, 15. The only people there were the people whose home were being used, and my dad and me. Nobody showed up. And, you know, by the fifth or sixth time on the way home one night, I said, Dad, why aren't people coming? I mean, I must have been like 13 or 14. He says, because people are frightened. I said, okay. So we do it again. Three, four more times, nobody shows up. I said, Dad, people are still coming. I said, what are we going to do? He said, work harder. That was his line. It wasn't working. Got to work harder. You've got to work harder. So, of all the lessons that I think I've ever learned, that may have been the most powerful. I think that was the most powerful lesson.
That was Fernando Chavez speaking with KALW's Lila Day. Luisa Cardosa helped produce that piece. To hear more from this series on the families of revolutionaries, go to KALW.org and click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Cesar Chavez felt the call to lead the United Farm Workers movement. Now we're going to shift to a different group who follow a different kind of call. That is the call of Cthulhu. It's a popular role-playing game, kind of like Dungeons and Dragons. The mechanics are simple. There's no actual board. Instead, players roll dice and battle imaginary bad guys. They interact in character within a storyline that's created and guided by a game master, kind of like an omnipotent god of the whole game's world. And for one game master in Oakland, Call of Cthulhu is her magnum opus. With another story from the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, here's Lacey Jane Roberts with the story.
We had the lights down pretty low. It was a bedroom that we had converted into kind of a library, and so it was really tiny. There was just barely enough room for the six of us and a table and chairs.
Janice Hill and her companions huddled together in the stuffy bedroom, unraveling a mystery. A family turned into rodent-like creatures by a terrible curse.
And it was hot. I remember it was very claustrophobic. And I think it was the second or third session.
The year was 1981. The place, Salinas, California. Hill spent her days working at an office supply store. But on the weekends, she ruled an alternate universe, one filled with terror and villains and magic. A parallel world where nearly anything was possible.
We had all these snacks and sodas and things, and right as I had given them some piece of really shocking information for the characters, one of the soda bottles blew its lid off and just went boom and exploded and, you know, sprayed all over the room. And it was at the perfect moment because they all shrieked and jumped. It was like, dun, dun, dun.
They were playing Call of Cthulhu, a tabletop role-playing game, or RPG. It's based on a short story by classic horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. And that night in Salinas was only the beginning.
I did some projections, though. If you go into the one of the...
Each game session is like writing a new chapter of the same story. And the story features a cast of characters invented and inhabited by the players.
Currently, my character is named Darling Doctor.
Niobe is my character that I play. And she is a diviner.
Dr. Montgomery Scott. He's well-educated, well-traveled, well-grizzled.
Today, we're sitting around Janice Hill's dining room table in Oakland, where that same story is still being played 35 years later.
As a widow, you know, I think my opportunities are even more increased now that I'm unfortunately grieving for my poor dead husband.
Don't you need a longer grieving period before...
Well, this is the 30s. You know, I am a modern woman.
The table's covered with wax-sealed envelopes, spiral notebooks, many-sided dice, and a bag of roasted garlic kettle chips. The players range in age from their 20s to their 50s. Lawyers, computer programmers, social workers. Hill sits at the head of the table, listening intently.
So we left off right at the end of April of 1933.
Occasionally looking up from her notebook to give direction.
And from there, you folks went to the big library in Tibet. And I still need to take you aside, Edward, and tell you what you found in France for your research.
Hill holds everything there is to know about the game universe in her head. She knows every character's motivation, every bad guy's next move, and every moment that has led to every event. It's her job to set the scene and keep the game moving forward.
Like directing a movie, you've got to know, okay, are we at a point where I need to kind of ratchet up the tension? Do I need to pull back?
The game world looks a lot like ours, except it's set in the 1930s, and there's a lot of supernatural stuff going on. Magical creatures interact with people all the time, like the Migo, or the Outsiders, an alien species with a taste for eating and possessing humans.
They're both evil. Beyond Everybody's evil.
Evil is something that terrible people do. These things are beyond comprehension and need to be immediately and completely eradicated and removed from our existence.
The elders.
No, the outsiders.
Oh,
but, also the elders.
The elders as well.
Yeah, the storyline gets complicated pretty quick, especially when you think about how, over 35 years, there have been more than 100 different players and thousands of hours of gameplay. Hill leads four different groups with five or six players each that meet every couple weeks.
Yeah, you can sit in the middle there, too.
I'll sit in the middle.
Okay, they can squeeze down.
Hill had no idea that the game she started back in that tiny Salinas bedroom would grow into an epic, world-spanning heroic journey. How epic is it? There are 16 banker's boxes in her basement filled with papers, documenting the first 15 years or so of the game's history. And that's just the time before her first home computer.
I don't want to say it's almost a full-time job, but it is almost a full-time job.
Hill's unusual, and it's not just because of the longevity of her game. When she started, women just didn't play these games, let alone rule them. Back then,
it was all about killing monsters and getting loot and saving the princesses, and women were extremely rare.
Not anymore. Hill actively recruits women for the game, even leading women-only groups, and she raised her daughters to love RPGs too.
My daughter Claire says that it was the best childhood she could have ever had because she was surrounded by creative people all the time.
And just like her family's part of her gaming life, the people in her games are part of her family. Now married couples met around Hill's dining room table. Some players spend holidays and birthdays together. They've built relationships around storytelling, just like humans have been doing around campfires for millennia.
Every game, we are all here to try to experience something where we can be heroic in our own minds, contribute, be part of a greater cause, or just have beer and pizza and smack on monsters and get that kind of exhilaration out of doing something.
Jasper Maskelyne, Darling Doctor, and the rest of the characters are safe, for now. But everyone knows the stakes. The next alien incursion is slated to hit at the end of the month, and anything can happen in the quest to keep the world safe.
I can't think of anything else in the world than I would rather be doing.
For Cross Currents, I'm Lacey Jane Roberts.
Lacey Jane Roberts is a reporter at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And now we want to hear from you. What game are you obsessed with? For me, it's Lingo. I love Lingo. You know, it's the one where you try to guess a five-letter word. That one. But now it's your turn. We want to know what you're playing. Call us at 415-264-7106 and leave a message. That's 415-264-7106 or email us at news@klw.org. We love hearing from you because you really make us what we are, listener-supported public radio. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff, who recently OD'd on Settlers of Catan, while line producer Liz Mack swears by the sheep strategy. I don't know what they're talking about. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by San Francisco's Megan Slankard. She says one of her favorite performances was singing the national anthem for the San Francisco Giants. Well, Megan will have a more intimate show tomorrow. She'll be at Doc's Lab in North Beach. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Watching